From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dennis Potter wrote two of the most interesting TV imports from the BBC, Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective. The Singing Detective was about a detective writer with a hideous and crippling combination of psoriasis and arthritis, a condition that the writer Dennis Potter has. There's a retrospective of Potter's work at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. We'll talk with him on today's Fresh Air. Science writer Timothy Ferris has been acclaimed for his explanations of how the distant stars and galaxies were formed. Coming up, Ferris turns his attention inward to how our minds work. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of opera finales featuring a never-before-recorded version of the ending of Turandot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Declaring that the constitutional right to abortion still exists, a federal appeals court in San Francisco today overturned a law from Guam that would have prohibited almost all abortions on the U.S. territory. NPR's Isabel Alegria reports.
The Guam law would make it a felony to perform an abortion unless a woman's life is at stake or two doctors certify she is in grave danger if the abortion is not done. The law was in effect in Guam only 4 days before a federal judge blocked it in March of 1990. The Guam law is one of several measures aimed at challenging the Supreme Court's 1973 decision in Roe v. Wade that legalized abortion. In today's unanimous ruling by three federal court judges, Judge William Canby said since the Supreme Court has yet to rule on Roe v. Wade, it would be, quote, both wrong and presumptuous of us now to declare that Roe v. Wade is dead, unquote. Laws similar to Guam's in Louisiana and Utah are being challenged in lower federal courts. A less restrictive law in Pennsylvania will be reviewed by the High Court later this month and could result in the repeal of Roe v. Wade. This is Isabel Alegria in San Francisco.
Libya announced today that it would retaliate for United Nations sanctions against it by expelling diplomats from seven nations that supported the arms and air travel embargo. The expulsion orders came as the UN Sanctions Committee met to discuss ways of enforcing the embargo. The Sanctions Committee said today that it will allow governments that are enforcing the sanctions to provide flights to evacuate their own citizens. All other civil flights are banned, as are sales of weapons to the government of Muammar Gaddafi. Libya retaliated today by saying that it will order seven embassies, including those of Japan, France, and Germany, to send some of their diplomats home. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton is taking aim at President Bush. The Democratic presidential candidate has all but forgotten his challenger, Jerry Brown. In a speech in Philadelphia today, he never mentioned Brown, but he did repeatedly criticize the president. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Philadelphia.
In what was billed as a major economic policy address by the Clinton campaign, the Arkansas governor said President Bush has the worst economic record of any president in 50 years. He said the Bush administration has produced slower economic growth, slower job growth, and slower income growth than any administration since the Great Depression.
Unless we decide that we're all going to be more responsible citizens, responsible for our common problems, we're in for more trouble.
President Bush was also in Pennsylvania today, and he promised universal access to college loans, something Clinton has been promoting since his campaign began. Clinton commented on the president's sudden change of heart. He said, and they say, I'm slick. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Philadelphia.
The Dow Industrials gained almost 13 points today to close at a record 3,366. This is NPR. United Nations envoy Cyrus Vance visited the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia today for talks with leaders of the nation's three ethnic groups and the Yugoslav Federal Army. Vance said he believed all-out war could still be avoided in Bosnia. Even as he spoke, however, federal forces were consolidating their control over a strategically important town near the Serbian border. Visegrad was the fifth town seized by Serbian-led forces in the past 2 weeks. The Serbian-led drive for territory in Bosnia was condemned today by the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. The French defense minister today announced huge cuts in France's armed forces. These cuts follow a decision by French President Mitterrand to suspend France's nuclear tests until the end of the year. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Defense Minister Pierre Jacques said France's military would be reduced by 24,000 troops. The largest cuts will be made to the Army, though the Marine and the Air Force will also be affected. Several bases in France will be closed down entirely. Jacques said the government aims to reduce French forces by 25% in the years to come. He said the cuts are a direct result of the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. Several other West European countries have also decided to reduce their armed forces. Opposition leaders in France are not pleased with the government's decision, however. Although they acknowledge that the military here could be smaller, they want the government to end the draft and create a professional army. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
An Army Corps of Engineers official said today that it could take another 3 days to plug the hole that allowed the Chicago River to flood miles of tunnels and basements under the downtown loop. An estimated 250 million gallons of water poured into the tunnel system this week, turning the city center into a disaster area and costing businesses hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Museum of Television and Radio in Manhattan is running a retrospective of the work of one of the most innovative writers in television, Dennis Potter. Most of his work has been done for the BBC. In America, he's best known for the series Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective, which were both shown on public television. He also wrote the screenplay for the American film adaptation of Pennies from Heaven, which starred Steve Martin and Bernadette Peters. Recently, Potter directed his first film, Secret Friends. What I respond to most in his work is the way he uses pop music from the 30s and 40s. In both The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven, when characters want to express their deepest feelings, they hear in their minds recordings of pop songs that express those thoughts. The characters, as if possessed by the songs, lip-sync along and are transformed by the music. The Singing Detective is about a middle-aged detective writer hospitalized with a horrible disfiguring condition, a combination of extreme psoriasis and arthritis. Dennis Potter himself is often stricken with this disease. In this scene, a female nurse is applying an ointment to the writer's raw thighs, and he is gravely embarrassed to find he's getting aroused, so he tries to think boring, distracting thoughts.
We can start now.
Oh, cock, do not crow. Poor cock, do not stir.
I'll be as gentle as I can.
Oh, think of something boring, for Christ's sake. Think of something very, very, very boring. A speech. A speech by Ted Heath. A sentence, a long sentence from Bernard Levin. A quiz by Christopher Booker. Oh. No. Think. Really boring. A Welsh male voice choir. Everything in punch. Oh.
Oh, poor thing.
Oh, wage rates in Peru. James Burke. Finnegan's Wake. All the bloody Irish. The dog in Blue Peter. Brian Clough. And especially James. Henry Ann Clive. Australian barman. Ecologist. Semiologist. Thing. Guardian Woman's Page. Oh, dear Christ. Yes. The Bible. Reader's Digest, special draw prize. No. Think Bible. Bible Psalms. Song of Solomon. Thy breasts are like... No. Oh.
Sorry. Is that too hard?
Too hard, yes. It's like iodine in a cut.
I'm sorry, but it's worst of all just here inside your thighs. I'm being as gentle as I can.
Oh, it's not your fault. No.
I'm sorry, but I shall have to lift your penis now to grease round it.
My mama done told me when I was in pigtails.
I have to talk to you about songs.
Songs.
Because I think it's so powerful, the way you express people's inner life and inner dreams and desires through the popular songs of the 30s and 40s. Did you want to live in the world of those songs?
No, many of those songs I actually hate, to be quite honest. It's like what Noah Coward said about the potency of cheap music. Some of those banal and silly, syncopated, syrupy lyrics and tunes, like much popular art, they make you do all the work. I mean, in themselves, intrinsically, they may not have that much value. But even the most drivelly, syrupy, syncopated piece of mush is in direct line of descent from the Psalms, in my opinion, in that they say, or they're seeking to say, that the dead, suffocating materiality of the real world and the way we're locked into it, that there is something else shimmering, something that may be very cheap and may be very banal, but it says, you know, that love is there and is forever, or the sun is shining, or it infiltrates into that. Because it's so easy and because it's so undemanding, it makes you do the work. It's a great art, of course, great music demands that you genuflect before, that you bend the knee to it, you give it, it demands your attention. Popular art in general makes you do the work because you put yourself into it, which is why in drama, using those songs and making the actors lip sync to them so that they're genuine artifacts from the past, like a costume would be or a piece of furniture might be, it enables me to feel as though I'm getting inside the head. And, you know, we all have this little theater on top of our shoulders, bobbing along on top of our shoulders.
Did anyone in your family sing?
My mother played the piano in the working men's club in the Forest of Dean, in this sort of coal mining village where I grew up. She sang, and she was popular as a result.
Was she transformed when she sang in any way?
Well, she was, and we were. In a sort of miners' club, for example, it was hardworking people drinking, yes. And as the evening wears on, some of the old songs would start coming out. And it was an odd place, Forest of Dean, anyway. It's like it's between the two rivers, the Wye and the Severn, on the borders of England and Wales. And was, when I was a child in the war, quite isolated and ugly villages because they were coal mining villages, but a genuine forest creeping right up to the back garden, as it were, a forest real enough to get lost in. And a landscape that was stony and green and grey and grubby all at the same time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dennis Potter, and he's probably best known in America for writing The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven. He wrote and directed the new movie Secret Friends. There's a retrospective of his work about to begin in New York. Your new movie, Secret Friends, is in part about the danger of fantasies and the danger of living out those fantasies. And that's really a recurrent theme in a lot of your work. And I was wondering if you lived in the fantasy world, if that was your place, coming of age in a coal mining town.
To a degree, I think everyone does to some degree. But there are fantasies and fantasies. I mean, fantasy can be one of those registrable sexual diseases, I think, for example. I mean, it can. You know that when people don't see each other true, when they don't deal with reality and allow fantasy to displace reality, you know that that is actually a form of illness. Yeah, but without some fantasy of some order or some... It's a kissing cousin to imagination, isn't it? And without that imagination to leaven and in a sense, order our experience, then we're less than human.
Another related theme that recurs in a lot of your work is growing up in a very repressive atmosphere, repressive parents, repressive teachers. Was that true for you? Did you grow up in a repressive atmosphere?
Well, I wouldn't say it was repressive. I mean, it had standards and had that right-wing part of myself will come out in a minute, because I do believe that those kinds of respect for order and decency and the working class culture that I grew up in coincided also with the fact that the world was mad. I mean, there were German planes overhead, making that peculiar broken noise, so you knew they were the German planes. They go, rather than one continuous note, and each horizon lit by searchlights. The assumption, first long word I ever learned, I used to love words as a child, I still do actually, but were the teachers leaning over the railings and opposite, there's this little village school and the oak trees opposite where we played. And I heard that France had capitulated. I loved the word capitulated. I didn't know what it meant. Ran all the way home. But capitulated in my mouth like a pebble, you know, like it was a jewel. I got a word, lovely new long word. I was five. But that was the word. So of course all those things were affecting the way one grew up. That the normal condition was there were Germans trying to kill you. And the assumption of England at that time, I mean, I think even little children were politicized. Everybody knew. And nobody thought we were going to lose. That was so amazing.
Getting back to the repressive atmosphere that is
you're really hung up on repression, aren't you?
Well, no, it's that it's in so much of your work. I figure it must be something that you've experienced and thought about a lot. I was wondering what kinds of things you were punished for when you were young.
Being naughty. I don't know. The ordinary things. There would be a smack or being uppity. Just objectively speaking, no immodesty or any of that. Just as a measurement, I do have a sort of off-the-scale IQ. And I was obviously very, very bright as a child as a result in a way that, you know, probably wasn't understood at that time. And it is a curse, actually, in a small, tight, suffocatingly interned, simple-ish working-class village to be, quote, clever, unquote, and to seek education in that way. And that.
Why is it a curse?
Well, because you will get bullied, won't you? If the teacher leaving the room says, come out to the front, Dennis, and tell us a story, that sounds like an honor. It's actually a punishment because you're going to be resented by the others. And I assumed that I was going to grow up and be a coal miner. They did and did. I didn't. I went through that treacherous minefield called the English class system, which involves betrayal. You don't know it at the time. You're too young to know it. I came from, you know, a culture that with a very strong dialect where people do and still do say thee and thou, you know, where bist thou going, O butty, or Surrey, they say, which is Sirrah. And it's only, 40 miles or so from Shakespeare's birthplace. And the accents of the people, which is also naturally in tune with the accents of the King James Bible, and that wonderful, simple English, which is resonant, aching with beauty and tenderness. But to go in that from there all the way by accident and examination to Oxford involves you making judgments about your own without knowing you're making, because you are seduced into making those judgments by what you think is of just learning and education. It does mean that you are trapped into making value judgments about your own home.
Is success interpreted as turning your back against your own class?
Well, it can be, and it is when you're very young. And if you start making judgments, because if you start thinking that an ability to speak Latin somehow, for example, makes you better than someone who doesn't and can't, or if you know more, or if you read more, or if you seek those things, you can, by the very arrogance of youth, you can be trapped into making those false judgments, and it's only later that you receive the pain of knowing that you have, although you've gained so much, you've also lost something. When I was used to, my dad is dead now, died in 1975, and he didn't read and things, but he was incredibly gentle and sensitive man whose life was spent in the pits. But when he'd talked about something in the past, he would somehow describe the color of the sky, or sometimes he'd draw an apple on the white margins of a newspaper. And when I would be writing, after I'd started writing television plays and so on. Sometimes I would be trying to finish something, and he'd come out, and he would lean on the door jamb, looking into the room where I was working, and I maybe was sort of slightly irritated, thinking, I don't actually want a conversation at this moment. I want to finish this scene, say. And he would say, "Is thou all right? Oh, but, Dan, you all right?" And I'd say, "Yes, thank you, Dad." "You sure you're all right now?" Within that accent. And, of course, now, if I could only say, "Oh, please, Dad, come on in."
Yeah.
But you can't, can you? But you can have a continuing relationship with the dead. Any parish includes the dead as well as the living.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dennis Potter, and he's best known in America for writing The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven, which were both produced for the BBC and shown in America on public television. He also wrote the screenplay for the film version of Pennies from Heaven, and he's written and directed a new movie called Secret Friends. We're going to take a short break. We'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dennis Potter is my guest. The main character in your screenplay, The Singing Detective, has a condition that combines psoriasis and arthritis,
yeah,
which is the condition that you have. When did you first get that?
30 years ago. It's like a plague, you know. People say, "Oh, I've got psoriasis," people say, and they mean they've got a few rings or scales on their skin, whereas this kind is... the killer kind, 100%. You cannot find a gap in your, you know, when it attacks first. It started actually with the arthritis in every single joint, went just like that. I was actually on this newspaper, the Daily Herald, which I'd left the BBC because I wanted politics, and obviously you cannot express political opinions as a staff member of the BBC. And I was covering a political conference at the press table. I was feeling a bit low anyway. I was sort of wallowing towards what I knew was a kind of desperate disappointment with things in general, without being able to say what specifically it was. But when I went to get up from the press table, I suddenly couldn't. I looked down thinking, what the hell is wrong? And my left knee, which is where it was like a football. You know, it was literally 4 or 5 times its proper size within those, what, half an hour or so. And I didn't know what it was. And it, in fact, took some time to diagnose properly what it was. And during that time, bang, I just went. And then my hands collapsed in. And it's still active, so I can't have those little rubber joints put in. So I can just move the forefinger and thumb. The other fingers are permanently down on the palm. But then, you know, with the steroid, you know, that long regime of treatment over... I'm talking now, this is the winter of 61, 62, and it began. I had 2 small children, and I had lost my job. In a way, I was lucky in that at the same time, I knew that I had to... In a way, it sounds crude, but I'm using it as a metaphor... I had to reinvent myself. I had to find in myself what it was, A, what it was that I was so wretchedly disappointed about without knowing what it was, if you follow me. But also, I'd always had this sense of... It's such an old-fashioned word, it makes people snigger, but of vocation, that there was some significance. And now that's perilously close to mental illness when you too readily admit to that condition. You're saying when you know that there is some significance to your life and that there is a vocation to which you should submit. The sheer desperation of that kind of opened up a, up the entry to a path that began to stretch ahead of me instead of behind me. So far from things seeming to be over, you know, and that one would be in a permanently medical nightmare, there actually was something stretching in front of me and beckoning me, and I submitted to it. It's the only way I can put it.
In The Singing Detective, your character, who has the same condition you do, says, "I've reached the end of my tether. I can't see clear of it. Even tears hurt the skin of my face. Mm. Talk about the Book of Job. I'm a prisoner of my own skin and bones." Mm. Was there a period where you felt that you reached the end of your tether?
No, not like that. I mean, that's an invention of... I mean, in The Singing Detective, I wanted to show a man with nothing except bitterness and rage reassemble himself via his cheap fiction and cheap music. I mean, they weren't the whole sources of his beginnings of self-knowledge, but through concentrating, in order to escape the pain and the humiliation of that scourge of an illness, he was remembering or trying to rewrite his own cheap detective pulp novel.
He has these fevered visions and hallucinations. Mm. Have you ever had that, and have you written your way
through
that?
Well, when the illness is at its height and pre the modern drugs, when it obviously the skin is a moderator too of your temperature, and when it's 100% psoriatic, and when every joint is also locked by arthritis, your temperature goes out the window, as it were. And although...
Up or down?
Up, 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 and up, and up, until you're in danger of that septicemia, which is the danger. So they do everything to bring your temperature down to a normal high temperature. At that point, although you know you're not actually hallucinating, but you do lose... Reality does shift in front of you. It's an unpleasant... It's a bit like dreaming, but you know you are. You never actually... You never don't know the difference between what is real and what isn't. But it is an uneasy... You feel that at any moment you're going to lose what is real and what isn't. That doesn't last too long. But once you experience it, you do know how perilously perched your rationality can be. You are perforce made to live in your body, and your body can let you down.
Just one last question about your condition. How has it changed your life to be able to not be bedridden and embarrassed to be seen in the way that you used to be?
Well, I have a tendency towards reclusiveness. I know that. And I know that that too can, although it's nice in a way for me, it can be dangerous. And I like, it's one of maybe one of the hidden reasons why I wanted to direct, you suddenly have to say hello and deal with hundreds of people. And in a very emotional way, I mean a very hard working, I mean a very concentrated way. You have to be out and dealing and functioning. That, maybe I've had enough of that reclusiveness, and it's nice to be like I was at Oxford or before, you know, when I was going to be a public man, a political man, as it were. I don't mean glad-handing.
Right.
But, you know, being out and about in the world is nice, and I'm responding to it, and it's a good creative feeling, and I'm very lucky.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you so much for spending some of your time with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Writer and director Dennis Potter. The Museum of Television and Radio in Manhattan is featuring a retrospective of Dennis Potter's work through May 31st. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the scientific search for extraterrestrial intelligence and the neurological search for the workings of human intelligence. We talk with award-winning science writer Timothy Ferris, author of the new book, The Mind's Sky. The composer Puccini died before he could complete his great opera, Turandot. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording featuring a never-before-recorded finale. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. One day after UN sanctions went into effect, Libya announced that diplomats from seven nations will be ousted. The UN Security Council wants Libya to hand over two suspects in the bombing of a Pan Am jet over Scotland 4 years ago and cooperate with a probe of the downing of a French airplane back in 1989. Under these sanctions, air travel to and from Libya is banned, and arms sales to Tripoli are suspended. Matt Fry of the BBC reports from Tripoli.
The expulsion will be on a strictly reciprocal basis. That means Germany, for instance, which has expelled two Libyan diplomats from Bonn, will lose the same number here. The retaliation makes little difference to Britain and the United States, the prime movers behind the UN sanctions. Neither country has diplomatic relations with Libya, and its embassies here have been closed for years. Another Libyan response to the sanctions has been to ban non-Libyan citizens from internal flights in Libya. This may affect workers in far-flung oil fields in the Libyan desert and people trying to reach Egypt. One diplomat in Tripoli described how Egyptians, Sudanese, and other foreigners were not allowed to board a domestic flight from Tripoli to Tobruk near the Egyptian border.
Matt Fryer, the BBC. UN diplomat Cyrus Vance says that he is hopeful that all-out war can be avoided in Bosnia. Vance made a statement after meeting with the various rival ethnic groups. He said, however, that it is a very complicated issue and a very hard road to walk. Vance called for an end to the fighting over Bosnia split from Yugoslavia, and he called on all sides to work for peace and talks with the European community. President Bush today called for the creation of a new federal program that would lend money to families to continue their education. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
President Bush calls his plan the Lifetime Education and Training Account.
A package of grants and line of credit worth $25,000 to every eligible American to further their education or acquire new job skills to make the most of their abilities.
The president said he wants to give working parents a chance to be more competitive in a future labor market. A person who never went to college, is out of college, or already in a training program would be allowed to borrow against future earnings, although there was no mention of how the money would be paid back or what the interest would be. The plan would also allow more people to qualify for existing federal grants and loans. Congress has been thinking about at least one similar bill, and presidential candidate Bill Clinton today complained that the president's proposal sounds a lot like his. Clinton, though, would allow borrowers to pay their loans back by performing community service. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 13 points to close at 3,366. This is NPR News. After defeating efforts in Parliament this week to limit his powers, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has told his cabinet to move ahead on current economic reforms. Monday, the Russian cabinet had threatened to hand over its resignation to protest efforts to control wages and prices and have Yeltsin give up the post of Prime Minister of Russia. U.S. officials had warned this measure endangered a $24 billion aid package, and Russia's parliament approved a pro-reform statement. In Los Angeles, officials today presented their choice for the city's next chief of police. He is Willie Williams, currently police commissioner of Philadelphia. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
In his first Los Angeles news conference, Willie Williams said he would address the concerns of the citizens and implement the reforms recommended by the Christopher Commission, the Blue Ribbon panel that studied the Los Angeles police force in the wake of the beating of black motorist Rodney King. Their report found evidence of racism and brutality in the LAPD. In Philadelphia, Williams has a reputation for being tough on officers who use excessive force and for advocating a community-based style of policing. Willie Williams will be the first Black to head the LAPD and the first chief in more than 40 years to come from outside the department. It is unclear when he will begin his new job. LA's current chief of police, the controversial Daryl Gates, has said he will retire sometime in June. Gates has civil service protection and cannot be forced out. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
A federal appeals court in San Francisco has overturned an abortion law on Guam that would ban almost all abortions there. The law passed in 1990 was in effect only 4 days before it was blocked by a federal judge 2 years ago. The appeals ruling today came on a vote of 3-0. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This year, NASA will begin the first official U.S. search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Science writer Timothy Ferris says regardless of whether we find intelligent life out there, this search will encourage us to focus attention on what we mean by intelligence. At the same time that astronomers are searching the skies, neurologists are studying the human brain, revealing fascinating things about human intelligence. In his latest book, The Mind's Sky, Human Intelligence in a Cosmic Context, Timothy Ferris examines questions that face us about intelligence in both the outer and inner worlds. Ferris is the author of several books on astronomy and physics, including Coming of Age in the Milky Way and Galaxies. His writing has been recognized with awards from the American Institute of Physics and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He teaches at the University of California at Berkeley. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, known by the acronym SETI, is still considered pretty fringy by some Americans. I wondered why Ferris supports it.
The real reason, I think, is that if we don't listen, we'll never know. There are a lot of good arguments that one can make for the existence of life and perhaps intelligent life, whatever exactly that may mean, on other planets. And most of these arguments have to do with numbers. There are just so many stars and presumably planets out there that even if life or intelligence were a rare phenomenon, you'd still expect it to crop up. But whether or not these arguments are correct, the problem with taking the opposite point of view is that you end up not listening. And to me, SETI is more a matter of exploration than of science. And the rule in exploration is, you know, you got to go out and have a look around.
How much money are you willing to spend on it? You know, times are so hard economically.
Well, I would be willing to spend probably.
How much
more
of your money, Timothy Ferris, are you willing to spend on this project?
Well, I would put up, a dollar a year, let's say. The NASA project actually will cost me only, and every other taxpayer, only about a nickel a year, so that seems reasonable enough.
Or is that really what it's costing us, 5 cents?
Yeah, it works out to around $10 million a year, and that works out to about a nickel per person.
Can you describe in a little bit more detail what NASA will be doing when it starts the SETI project later this year?
The NASA will use a couple of radio telescopes to examine sun-like stars, stars like our own sun, which constitute about 10% of the more than 200 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, which, by the way, is just one of a great many galaxies. This detailed search will look for signs of artificial signals. What you do is you put a receiver that can examine a huge number of radio frequencies on the radio telescope and a custom-designed computer to discard everything that looks natural. There's a lot of natural radio noise coming in from the nebulae and galaxies, and that's why we have radio telescopes. They're primarily to conduct ordinary science. And so you have to sift through all this looking for the spike of an unnatural signal. The other survey, the all-sky survey, is at a lower level of sensitivity, but examines a large area so that if you have a powerful signal coming from further away, it might make it through. The problem with SETI is an embarrassment of riches. The sheer abundance of stars, the very abundance that makes us think there might be life out there in the first place, also means that you have to look at a tremendous number of stars before you would have a reasonable chance of seeing something. Suppose, for instance, that, take an optimistic scenario, there are 10,000 alien civilizations out there all broadcasting beacons our way, and you had a radio telescope that could go from one star to another and examine each one for about an hour and move on. For that search to have a 50-50 chance of hitting one of those stars around which orbited a planet on which there was one such civilization would take something like 50 or 100 years. So SETI is a business where you have to be prepared to go in for the long haul. It's you have to resist the human tendency, the very human tendency, to say, oh, gee, we haven't got any results here. We've been at it for 10 years, so there must be no one out there.
One of the chapters in your book that I found particularly interesting was about near-death experiences, and this is part of your search to understand how the human mind operates. And I think a lot of our listeners have probably read accounts of near-death experiences that have described it as being sheathed in light, being very peaceful, being an almost ecstatic experience. What were some of the experiences that you read that got you interested in this subject?
Well, you know, we've had a sort of a series of near-death fads.
Yes, right. Yes, exactly.
It comes and goes, and more people now have, you know, are revived than ever before in, mm-hmm. in operating rooms, typically in emergency wards, after their vital functions have ceased. One of my old childhood friends has twice been clinically dead, and he told me that he both times had this experience of passing through the veil of light, and he saw his favorite uncle and everything, who told him to go back. He, by the way, attaches no significance to this. He doesn't think that, you know, he's gone into the afterlife or anything of that sort. And I don't think you can make that claim. The near-death experience clearly doesn't have anything to do with a view of an afterlife. But, and the reason I say that is because people in high-stress situations, there's a fabulous little book called The Experience of Dying in Falls that was published around 1890 or so by a Swiss doctor and alpinist who had a serious fall himself and went around interviewing other climbers who had survived falls, and he found they had the same experience. They pass through the tunnel and they see their relatives and their life passes before their eyes. Well, a healthy 25-year-old climber who's falling 400 feet through the air on a crisp spring day in Jungfrau isn't dead. You know, he's not even ill. He just has every reason to believe that he's about to be dead. So if he has the same experience that people do in these near-death experiences, then the near-death experience is not about death, it's about stress. But it still fascinates me. Why, when you're right at death's door, as they say, should you experience ecstasy? This seems a marvelous question to me. It's an interesting sort of evolutionary question, so I'm trying to call a little attention to that aspect of it.
Why do you see it as an evolutionary question?
Well, I assume that all the fundamental mechanisms of the human nervous system have evolved. Well, they obviously have evolved, but that they have an evolutionary story to tell, you know. Let me give you an example of what I mean. If you are attacked by a bear, as I seriously hope will never happen, a lot of things will suddenly happen to you that make evolutionary sense. You'll get a big dose of adrenaline in the bloodstream. Time will seem to slow down. Muscular strength will increase tremendously for a short period of time. Endorphins released into the bloodstream will cause your pain threshold to be greatly elevated so that you'll feel little or no pain. Well, there's clearly a good evolutionary mechanism for producing all these things, since people who have these experiences are more likely to be able to survive. But I can't imagine what evolutionary value there is in extreme stress, in having your life pass before your eyes, or in seeing your favorite grandmother or something of that sort. So it's a fascinating puzzle to me. I talked to Lewis Thomas about this question many years ago, and he had an idea involving a harmony, that there are harmonies within webs of living systems. At the time, I thought that was primarily a poetic idea, but I've become more interested in what's called information theory, which is a way of looking at the philosophy of science. And I'm beginning to wonder whether harmonies might be in fact, fundamental to all communication, and communication in turn fundamental to all life. It might be that the reason that we and other species might turn out to be interested in communicating with one another among the stars may be some inchoate, deep-seated reason that has to do with the very nature of life. In other words, life itself may be here for a reason that has to do with communication. And while that sounds like a mystical idea, I only express it because as the years go by, I'm beginning to think that it's not mystical at all, but may turn out to be as fundamental to our understanding of nature as atoms and quarks.
My guest is Timothy Ferris, and he's the author of the new book, The Mind's Sky, Human Intelligence in a Cosmic Context. We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Ferris. He writes about astronomy and physics. He's the author of the bestseller Coming of Age in the Milky Way and the new book The Mind's Sky. You know, you're getting back to the question of why are so many near-death experiences almost ecstatic. Some people would think that you are wrong in so easily dismissing the idea that it's not a view into the afterlife.
Mm. Well, I'm not trying to dismiss it. I'm simply saying, as I say in the book, I'm not trying to render a judgment on the whether or not there is such a thing as an afterlife. But I do think it's clear that the near-death experience does not constitute proof of the existence of an afterlife. It's much more likely that the opposite is the case, that we formed an impression of heaven as an ethereal realm of light where you meet the dearly departed, because those occasional people who made it through these severe stress situations and came back reported just such a thing. So we can't very well, if indeed our concept of heaven was formed out of reports of near-death experiences, we can't then turn around and say that near-death experiences support the concept of heaven. That's to reason in a circle.
Your new book has a chapter on mysticism in it. What scientifically interests you in mysticism?
Well, probably not much scientifically, but a lot personally. If you read the writings of the great mystical writers like Lao Tzu in China, this is clearly marvelous stuff. And mystical thinkers have enjoyed a great currency even amongst the most hard-headed empirical scientists. Einstein is a good example, who always insisted, as he put it, that the most beautiful experience accessible to us is the mystical experience, and he was a fairly mystical guy himself. So I've tried to explore what might be going on in the mystical experience in terms of the architecture of the brain, and it's only a preliminary reconnoitering of this question. But it's an interesting one. It may turn out in the future that mystical reports are sort of like, you know, frontier Lewis and Clark reports about the inner architecture of the brain, and that in centuries to come, when we understand the brain a lot better, this literature will be looked back upon as those were, you know, and as the explorers' reports were, when you had early preliminary maps and you'd look at them and say, oh, look, they had part of Florida, but they didn't know about Texas, you know, and that sort of thing. I think, in other words, that the mystical experience is not some kind of delusion, as some scientists seem to think, or something that we're going to get past. I think it's something fundamental to the human experience.
Science writer Timothy Ferris. His latest book is called The Mind's Sky, Human Intelligence in a Cosmic Context. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up later from NPR, we'll be hearing news of events in Afghanistan and the whereabouts of Afghanistan's President Najibullah, who apparently has been ousted. Also, a report on health care for women in the former Soviet Union. The level is not very high. What's happened with condom sales in the United States over the past 5 years? 4 years ago, there was a big increase. Not so in the past couple of years. A report on what Governor Bill Clinton proposes in the way of national economic policy, and some very different ideas about the economy and the federal government from free market Nobel laureate economist Milton Friedman. Those stories coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The composer Puccini died before he completed the last scene of his opera Turandot. His young friend Franco Alfano was commissioned to finish the opera from the master's sketches. But the complete version of Alfano's ending was never performed until 1982. Now the very first recording of this famous finale has been released, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
The world premiere of Puccini's Turandot took place at La Scala in 1926, nearly a year and a half after the composer's death. Toscanini conducted. It was already a highly charged evening. Mussolini had refused to attend the premiere because Toscanini had refused to play the fascist anthem, Giovinezza. Just before the final scene of the opera, right after Nessun Dorma and the death of the servant girl, Liu, Toscanini put down his baton and announced to the audience that this was the point where Puccini had died. He then stepped down from the podium. Puccini's inability to complete Turandot certainly caused a lot of trouble, considering how little music he actually had left to write. Toscanini was in charge, and the young composer Franco Alfano was not his first choice to complete the opera. Toscanini evidently made Alfano expand his original ending, and then Toscanini himself abridged it. It's this shortened version that gets performed. The plot of Turandot concerns a Chinese ice princess who doesn't want to marry. She agrees, however, to marry the man who can answer her three riddles. Whoever tries and fails, though, pays with his head. When a mysterious prince answers the riddles, Turandot is horrified. The prince offers to put his life in her hands if she can discover his name. Finally, he tells her his name, and she realizes that she's in love with him. It's the love duet, which uses earlier themes from the opera, that Puccini didn't finish. And even with a great actress like Maria Callas, the ending has always seemed an anticlimax. But Alfano's original ending is 4 minutes longer than Toscanini's abbreviated version, and it's really much more psychologically convincing. It fleshes out Turandot's reactions, gives her a little more time to accept her fate, to admit that she's fallen in love. Here's the moment of Turandot's first kiss on the wonderful old Callas recording. Now here's the same passage in Alfano's original version. This is from a new recording with the British soprano Josephine Barstow, the Italian tenor Londo Bartolini, and John Maucheri conducting the Scottish Opera Orchestra and Chorus. Barstow is an intensely theatrical singer. She and Maucheri help convince us that this is the better ending. Of course, no one knows what Puccini himself might actually have written. This London compact disc also includes the great finales from Richard Strauss's Salome, Luigi Cherubini's Medea, and best of all, Leos Janacek's The Macropolis Case. Barstow is quite terrifying as the 337-year-old Elena Macropolis, who finally has to face her death.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Josephine Barstow's recording of opera finales on London Records. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one of the greatest songwriting teams in rock and roll history. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller collaborated on such songs as Kansas City, Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, and Stand By Me. Their songs have been recorded by everyone from Elvis Presley to Peggy Lee. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.